You're listening to New Retirement Radio, brought to you by the team at Prout Financial Design.
Hello, I'm your host, Certified Financial Planner Dennis Prout.
I'm Heidi Cartwright, Financial Advisor and RICP.
I'm Deanne Jennings, and I'm here to share data and dive into the world of finance with you.
Advisors associated with Prout Financial Design may be either 1, registered representatives with and securities offered through LPL Financial, member FINRA SIPC, and investment advisor representatives of CG Advisory Services, a registered investment advisor, or 2, solely investment advisor representatives of CG Advisory Services, a registered investment advisor, and not affiliated with LPL Financial. Investment advice offered through CG Advisory Services, a registered investment advisor, CG Advisory Services, and Prout Financial Design are separate entities from LPL Financial. Dennis Prout and Nathan Prout are solely investment advisor representatives of CG Advisory Services and are not affiliated with LPL Financial. The opinions voiced in this show program are for general information only and are not intended to provide specific advice or recommendations for any individual. To determine which strategies or investments may be suitable for you, consult the appropriately qualified professional before making a decision.
WTCM News Talk 580, welcome aboard another edition of New Retirement Radio with Prout Financial Design in Traverse City, Michigan. Joining us today, Mr. Dennis Prout. Good morning, sir.
Well, it's so good to be here. Thank you, Ron. On Thursday, the 30th of May, 2024, it's just fun out and about and alive in these great parts here, Traverse City, Northern Michigan, the lakes, all of it. We'll take it. And joining us here this morning, too, Heidi Cartwright, our own managing director. Good morning, Heidi.
Good morning, Dennis. I'm delighted to be here today. Thank you.
Glad to have you. And Deanne Jennings, Director of Operations. Good morning, Deanne.
Good morning, Dennis, and good morning to all our listeners. Thank you for being with us this morning.
Hey, the internals are all working here. The things, the mics.
And mics all of for
that.
Everybody.
You betcha. And including our guest, by the way, welcome to each one of you for joining us. We really appreciate you listening in. If you do have a question of a financial nature related to elder law planning, that would be welcome here this morning. Ron, our number is, if you would.
You can phone us or text us. Same number both ways, 231 area code, call 947-0023.
And joining us today is Deb Riso. Deb Riso of RisoLaw.com, 231-649-2903. You've been doing this for 20 years.
I have. Hmm. Isn't that crazy?
Did that happen?
I know. I specialized right out of law school. I moved up here and I had the luck to go right directly into specializing in elder law, which was marvelous, really, because, you know, I didn't have to fight other lawyers. I didn't have to fight to figure out what I was going to do. I had a career right out of the gate.
You knew from the get-go that's what you wanted to do.
I did, actually. So when I was young, my mother thought I was a very strange child. I started volunteering at a nursing home when I was probably about 10.
Aww.
And wow. I just wanted to do it. And I did it through junior high and high school. And so I always liked working with the elderly. So it was perfect for me. And thank you, Ron and Dennis, for having me. Mm-hmm. It's marvelous. I really appreciate it.
Well, we've talked with you previously about this, and this is deep conversation, and I think it begs the question. We've had attorneys on in the last months, and it seems like we've been having more of these conversations. Well, guess what? We're thinking more about it. Clients seem to be more sensitized to it. And we're doing this ourselves in terms of trying to plan for the future, but thinking about, in some cases, the worst case scenario. Others, how do we deal with life as it throws its curveballs to us in terms of planning, the elder law side, Medicaid planning, all of it? First question that I want to ask to you is, what issues do you most often see with clients? What are the standard side, if you will, that you often see with clients? And then how do you handle those issues?
So I would say there's two primary areas of law or kind of types of planning that I do. I do estate planning, which is trusts, wills, powers of attorney, and deeds. And then I also do a lot of Medicaid planning for long-term care. And those two things can be very, very different. The clients can be very, very different. When people are coming in just for estate planning and nothing's wrong and they're just trying to get their ducks in a row, mm-hmm. that is not nearly as stressful or emotional as the Medicaid planning part. The Medicaid planning part, somebody needs long-term care for some reason. And that can be cognitive, that can be dementia, Alzheimer's, that can be physical, it can be a massive stroke. And that always has more emotional components. What I see a lot of with that is that people are afraid of what they don't know because it's a really difficult type of situation to navigate, and we're unprepared for it. So, you know, growing up, you always hear, you got to have a will, you got to have a will, and that's good enough for everything. And it's not. So the long-term care component just takes people by surprise so much. They don't plan for it. They don't know how to plan for it. And so then they're really stressed out by somebody being sick, maybe dying. And then they're also really stressed out because they don't know what to do with their documents or with their assets or any of that, where to put someone. So what I would say I see a lot of in conjunction with that is a lot of caregiver burnout. I see a lot, and this week I think probably 80% of my clients I saw this week had caregiver burnout because they're helping take care of mom, take care of dad.
Okay, sorry. Let's stop for a moment. So what you're seeing is you're seeing people right in the middle of the highest, might be some of the most stressful times in their lives dealing with mom or dad in a care situation where they've been giving the care.
Yes.
All right.
And it's super common, and it makes sense. People want to try to take care of a family member, but I always say it's the most difficult job in the world. And most people really can't handle it for a variety of reasons or can't handle it in perpetuity because it's so stressful. You never get a break. You're always kind of on call. And it's sad to watch a family member decline as well.
And we talked earlier this week, and we talked a little bit about the guilt, too.
Yes.
And that hit me a little bit because you have such an emotional attachment to the person. Plus, they may have said, like you said, maybe casually they said to you, well, you know, don't ever let me go into a nursing home or something. And so you have that weighing on you, and you don't want to fail, you don't want to let that person down, but maybe it's beyond your capacity. And you giving permission to people, I thought that was very interesting. Can you talk about that permission?
Yes. So one of the things that I do, I mean, I kind of have a counselor hat as well as a lawyer hat because I've been dealing with this for so long in this community. So I'm familiar with a lot of the resources in this community. And I do give people permission and almost instruct them quite often to place their loved one in a facility because it's necessary. A lot of times these people really need 24-hour skilled care or at least assisted living with, you know, RNs on duty and people constantly who are trained in the medical field to provide care. Most people aren't trained that way, and they're trying to provide this care that is beyond their capacity. So, and it's sometimes just wrong. They shouldn't be doing it. The mom or the dad or the spouse needs more care. So I very often will say, I think it's time to place this person. And usually the people in their world agree. The doctors agree. The family members agree. And it is just the guilt that we feel about, you know, making that decision for a loved one, because a lot of people do say, take me out back and shoot me.
Yeah, exactly.
Before
isn't
you
that
put
funny?
Me in a nursing home, and I always tell everyone, never tell anybody that because it really increases the guilt.
People always say that, though. I mean, they'll say, take me out back, or, you know, before I get to that point, don't let that happen to me. And there's nothing we can do.
Right. You can't actually take Dad out and shoot him.
No.
And not even, not, you wouldn't even if you could.
Of course not.
I've heard others say, well, you know, when it's time, just put me in the nursing home. And then when they're there, as that person, they really don't want to go. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the other part of it, too. Of course, many, they're just not at the point, they believe, where they think it's time to go to a nursing home. That's a tough navigation.
When people are suffering from a cognitive impairment, it's easier in my mind when they're really, really a danger to themselves to say they need to go into a facility. What I also see is I will tell my clients the opposite sometimes. They'll say, you know, Mom is 95 and she's still at home and we're really worried she's going to fall and die. And so they want to put that person into a facility. And I will actually discourage those people. I will say, if Mom wants to fall at home and die, that's okay. I mean, I'm not encouraging it, but I think there's a balance between kind of letting that person decide and you know, that's a difference between they're not in a caregiver situation. It's where I really push when there's a caregiver situation, because people owe it to themselves and usually their spouses to put themselves first. Because they'll put this parent who's aging, usually dying, before themselves, before their spouse. And I don't think that's fair to them, to their spouse, a lot of times their kids. So I think people have to really think about all of these kind of, issues.
Dynamics.
Yeah.
The dynamics of the situation.
What about home health care, getting a paid health care person to come into the home or live in the home as opposed to taking a person to a nursing home?
It's really expensive if it's 24-hour care. A lot of people do use some of the companies to supplement family members who are living there, and I think that's great if it works. It doesn't always work both financially and because a lot of times the person in the home getting the care may have a cognitive impairment where they're ornery. And they may like one caregiver but hate the other caregivers. And then the caregivers a lot of times just have a high turnover anyway because that's a difficult job. And I mean, I'm talking about like comfort keepers and, you know, these paid services. But I think they're wonderful. And I think if that works, great. That would be the first choice.
So if it's a way, if it's a way to navigate, it, maybe Mom or Dad needs some care during the day or whatever.
Yes.
You need some help. But it's not to the extent of 24-hour care. That's where that
It's rare. I've only seen a handful of people hire, you know, somebody to come in 24 hours a day.
Yeah, that's serious, yes.
Yeah.
So you also mentioned placement services within the Traverse City region area here. Tell us about that. What is that?
There's two placement. There may be more than two, but there's two ones that I primarily work with. One of the people is Connie Hensela. One is Kim Baumel. They're both wonderful. And they will help help you navigate where to put a person. And so, you know, I was laughing about looking in the phone book and opening up to the yellow pages. I'm showing my age. That we don't want to do that.
You can't do that anymore.
We don't want. That's not how you want to pick a facility for somebody. And these two people work with all of the facilities, so they know who has openings. They can look at the person's social needs, physical needs, financial situation, maybe religious or spiritual needs, and maybe, you know, they have a dog. They know who can take people. So it takes that homework out.
Who are these people again? How would someone get in touch with either one of these?
One is called the Alliance. That's Connie Hensela's, and then Kim Baumel's is Options for Senior Living, I believe.
Okay.
I don't have their phone numbers on me like right now, but they're in the phone book.
All right.
And we were talking about this the other day when we met and got together, and you were saying a lot of people think that lawyers just, you know, create the paperwork, draw it up, and hand it over, and that's it. And I love the fact that you're talking about right now that you sit with a client, you're drawing up the paperwork, but you're also talking to these placement services online, you know, with your client right there in the office. And I just think that's really neat.
Thank you. I try really hard to help my clients, and a lot of my clients, especially some of my older female clients, their husbands always took care of all the money, and now their husband is in a facility or died, and it's so overwhelming to them. The internet's overwhelming. The assets are overwhelming. They don't really know what they have because the husband always took care of it. Sometimes it goes the other way, too, that the wife always took care of it. That's something that, you know, encourages me to sit down and help them. I really do try to get, you know, the right services for people, get them connected the right way.
Mm-hmm. I have a couple of questions from listeners on the text line.
Sure, you bet.
Someone said, I had a family member pass away recently that left two wills. Ooh. The newest will was left unsigned. However, this is the one that was probated. Is this normal if it was unsigned?
I would say no.
Not normal.
I've never done that. I don't know how they got away with that. That seems weird. Mm-hmm. But maybe the court agreed that it was more properly that person's intent. I feel like the court would have to get involved to consent to that.
Okay. And the other question, is there a time limit or is it ever too early to have a medical power of attorney? We're only 54 in excellent health.
I preach this constantly. Every single person, when they turn 18, should have a financial power of attorney and a medical power of attorney. Because we're all human. We can all get in car accidents. We can all have a heart attack or anything where you're incapacitated. And just because you're the parents, if that person is 18, you're no longer that person's guardian or conservator. So everybody should have those two documents.
Hmm. So you would deem that the most important document to have, perhaps, in many situations, the financial and health durable powers of attorney, if you will.
Especially the financial in my world. I was laughing the other day when I was talking to Dennis that the financial durable power of attorney is my favorite estate planning document. It can get, especially if it's a good one, if you do nothing else, at least somebody can do a lot for you. If you're alive, they end with death, but if you're alive, people can really do a lot with that document. Medical is important too, but I will say in my world it's a little less important. I don't see it come into play nearly as much, but I'm not dealing, you know, I don't work at Munson. But I have talked to Munson, and I know I used to talk to the person in the advanced care department, and she said if you don't have one, Munson really still tries to work with the family kind of logically and make decisions about people.
Well, I thought it was so interesting when you mentioned the other day that 18 is when, and like you said, you're no longer under your parents. But I had heard that it was important, especially if you're traveling overseas and something happens to you and you need funds or you need something done here
yes.
on your behalf so you can get care overseas. And I thought that is really smart because so many kids these days in school, they'll do those international education semesters. And very interesting, especially if you're traveling, I think, internationally.
Right. And you're absolutely right. It doesn't always have to be that something's wrong with the person. It can just be they're traveling and somebody else needs to do something for them. And that is really common with kids in college. Parents need the kids to sign, you know, student loan paperwork or whatever. And, yeah, they're in Europe.
Wow. So where the rubber hits the road, if you will, the practicality of these documents, you see it, it sounds to me, almost every day of the week in terms of not just planning and having those documents, but seeing them put in place and in action.
Yes.
For care, for helping others see how their way through in some cases. How do we get through this caregiving situation? And then also handling the significant responsibility all of us have been placed under in handling these different accounts, 401ks, the IRAs, the real estate, the cottage,
yes.
all of that stuff.
Yes.
I have perhaps a related question
yes,
on the text line, and hopefully the it's thorough enough to provide an answer. It says, how do you handle disproportionate allocation of the estate due to home valuation, $1 million, with $1 million other assets, with three siblings, wish to keep the home for the family use. It's on a lake. One sibling wants the home for retirement. So enough information for you to respond to that?
It is, and that's really a common situation, and it varies. There's not a really simple answer to that. I have honestly not seen a single family cottage trust or family LLC successfully preserve real estate. I have seen, I think, every single one I've seen people squabble down the road because we've got such valuable real estate and the children are usually of disparate wealth and, you know, one wants to keep it, one doesn't, but they don't want to pay off the other one or they want a discounted value. So that is a tricky situation. Most lawyers would say a cottage LLC or cottage trust. I try to avoid them and figure out, let's be realistic about the possibility of the family squabbling and let's prevent that. But you can have, you know, one, I mean, my approach is usually that if they want to buy each other out, they get an appraisal and they buy each other out. Usually I do a trust with that just to have those terms in the trust to direct the trustee of what to do.
So that can work, but it's in a rare circumstance that the cottage trust would work. In your mind, what you've seen
it's
in
what
reality.
I've seen, yeah. Okay. So that's not prevailing ideology. Most attorneys would say, oh, yeah, they work great. Yeah. But I haven't seen them work, including a very dear family friend. Her family is, her parents died, and they are fighting. Mm. So I've seen it personally. I have seen it professionally. And that's just me, though. I mean, lots of attorneys. And I'm sure they work successfully, obviously, or they wouldn't exist. But my experience is that, especially when it passes down a few generations, whatever technique was being used doesn't work once you get down two generations.
The other thing that I would say in terms of retirement accounts versus the house, there's a very different tax reality between those assets. Those retirement assets are, unless it's in Roth accounts, are 100% taxable. So take a look at your children's ability to handle the tax, to handle that responsibility, to manage it, and the real tax implications for each of them and who's going to be served well. And as Deb just mentioned, are you sure they're going to want to handle the house? And if one wants it, put it within the trust that that one gets to buy it out at some kind of a discounted appraised price, whatever that might look like. All kinds of ways to do that instead of having a cottage trust and let it go into perpetuity.
And I'm not sure if this is what they were asking, but I'm not a big fan of we're going to leave the cash to our son Mike and we're going to leave the real estate to our daughter Susan.
Mm-hmm.
That always ends up unequal.
Yeah.
And sometimes if the kids are fine with it, that's fine, but it's never going to be an equal distribution.
No. Because we don't know what the tax rates are going to be in the future. Yeah. And over what time frame they're going to take it out as well.
Right.
Yeah.
One of the things on the topic of taxes that elder law attorneys also are pretty darn familiar with is income taxes of retirement accounts, property taxes, capital gains taxes, where I don't see that a lot of other attorneys really understand the impact of death or giving them away. So that's a kind of another area that I wouldn't say we really specialize in, but we have to know that. And part of our planning, you know, we don't want somebody getting a $50,000 tax bill that we didn't realize was coming because we didn't know something. So that's part of an elder law attorney is we are going to understand the tax implications of whatever we're talking about doing.
Great.
Speaking of housing and estate planning, could you briefly describe what a ladybird deed is? Because we seem to hear it more and more, and there's confusion out there, and people don't know about it. Could you just briefly describe what that is?
Sure. A ladybird deed is basically a beneficiary deed. So it's used typically instead of a trust, although sometimes the property will pass to a trust through a ladybird deed. But usually it's we've got mom and dad leave, or just one of them, signing and recording a deed now that has the effect of passing to the kids usually, but it can be somebody else upon their death. So it's not a gift. It doesn't trigger any capital gains taxes. It's not adding a joint owner. That's usually not a preferred method to pass real estate because you then take on the liability of that joint owner, and there's just problems with it. So a Ladybird deed does not trigger Medicaid's five-year look-back period. It does currently avoid the estate recovery law, where the state of Michigan tries to come back after a Medicaid recipient dies and make a claim against their estate. That is currently limited to probate estates. So for anyone on Medicaid, long-term care Medicaid, with a piece of real estate, they should have a Ladybird deed, or the state's going to have a valid claim against their house when they die.
Wow.
And this is really misunderstood by people because, you know, you always hear you can have your house under the Medicaid rules, and that's generally true, although they have an equity limit of $713,000, which seems like a really sky-high equity limit, to sort of, but it's not anymore. So if your house is worth more than that, you got maybe a Medicaid issue right out of the gate. But if your house is worth less than that, and you do this on your own, you really run the risk, like apply for Medicaid on your own, you really run the risk of not knowing something like this, that you needed a Ladybird deed, and then your parent dies, and then you get this letter from the state of Michigan, and lo and behold, they have a claim for $100,000 or however much they've paid out.
Because that house had to go through probate because it wasn't deeded properly for the transfer at death.
Yes. So Ladybird deeds, I would say I do more Ladybird deeds than I do deeds into trust. I do both, and there's reasons to do both. But Ladybird deeds are super common because they're pretty affordable and they're simple. But you've got to have all the people on it getting along. So, like, for example, I'm the youngest of seven children. My parents have a trust because there's too many kids. It's too hard to get seven kids all together and signing.
And all agreeing.
Right. So, you know, but Ladybird deeds are really a very effective document.
So we've got several questions here regarding Medicaid. We want to get into this happy subject. What are the general Medicaid rules? And again, thank you for joining us. This is interesting. For a lot of reasons, obviously. So what are the general Medicaid rules for long-term care?
The very first thing I'm going to say is that Medicaid's really hard to speak about generally because it's extremely fact-dependent, and the rules are really complicated. And people always want to say, this is how it is. You know, everybody has to do this, everybody has to do that, and that's false. There's a lot of different factors in Medicaid planning. So this is going to try to be general, but it is, again, really fact-dependent. So for a single person, the asset level is a house worth less than $713,000, and they use double the state equalized value on your property tax bill to calculate that. So you don't have to look on Zillow and use the really high value. And then $2,000, a funeral, and a car. There are planning techniques for a single person to protect excess assets. Typically, about half of the cash can be protected, whatever the other assets are. But if you get too high into assets, a lot of times people are going to forego Medicaid altogether because there's tax implications and problems. So I generally say with single people, and this is not hard and fast, but I try to like to give people kind of a threshold of when they should realize maybe Medicaid might be relevant for them. So for a single person, I say if you've got a house, a car, and $200,000 or less, or even up to $300,000 if you've got something like early onset dementia but good health, that would be somebody who might want to be looking at Medicaid planning to protect the house, the car, and about half of the other assets. And the way we do that with a single person is through the use of a Medicaid annuity and some gifting. When I'm talking about Medicaid, I'd like to kind of clarify. I'll go back to married couples in a minute. But I'd like to clarify, what is Medicaid? Why are we talking about this? Like, I probably should have started with that. But Medicaid is the government benefit that helps pay for long-term care. And usually, most of the time, here at least, it's going to be paying for the 24-hour skilled nursing facilities like the Grand Traverse Pavilions, like the Medi Lodges, like the Villas, it used to be Bort's. And then now we have the PACE Center, which is the Program for All-Inclusive Care for the Elderly, and that's a wonderful program.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Dennis.
Good plug. You bet. Appreciate it.
And that a lot of people will want Medicaid, but there's an income cap for that. The asset rules are the same, but there is an income cap for that. It is $2,829 a month. So if you earned more than that, whoever's seeking it, like in your Social Security and pension, you're simply not going to get Medicaid for PACE because your income's too high. And I believe it's $5,000 a month private pay. Don't quote me on that. That's a great service if it fits your needs. It's really wonderful. It can help people stay at home. Mm-hmm. Usually works best for one spouse being at home or a child being at home so that there's somebody there at night. Mm-hmm. But PACE can help kind of keep people out of facilities and provide some services, and it's wonderful.
So for those with incomes of less than $34,000 a year, then they're going to qualify for some kind of Medicaid if they meet all the health constraints.
For PACE, but there's still the asset criteria.
Yeah,
and the asset criteria is the same for all the types of Medicaid I'm talking about. And then there's also My Choice Waiver, which has got a variety of different names, home and community-based waiver. That is the type of Medicaid that can pay for some assisted living facilities, not all. They definitely don't all take it. And some in-home care. And that I haven't seen in a long time, really. I don't know why, but I feel like it's kind of hard to staff in people's houses. So going back to the married couple criteria, I try to start with a, you know, general threshold of when should people be considering this as something they should think about. Again, I say about $400,000 to $500,000 liquid, house, car, funeral. If you've got $1 million or two, a lot of my clients have $2 million, they're not going to probably ever want to go down a Medicaid path. And people don't really know when they should be thinking about it or not. So I just try to give general ideas of who might want to be thinking about it, who might not. So if you're wealthy, you're probably not going to ever need any Medicaid. So for a married couple, we've got a few different planning techniques that work quite well, and we can typically protect darn close to everything with the exception of maybe some income tax implications if we have to cash out IRAs to do Medicaid planning. But we can typically preserve all the rest of the assets. So for married couples, if you've got $100,000 and a house and one of you's got dementia, you would be an ideal Medicaid client. You would be really who we'd be wanting to protect that money for the spouse at home, because we need to protect the money for the other person. So there's a lot of really good, solid techniques that we can use to do that. And that is, again, through the use of either a Medicaid annuity or a special kind of trust called a sole benefit trust. And then sometimes it also works to have your house in a regular revocable living trust ahead of time as a married couple. This is a weird Medicaid rule, but if your house is in a trust, Medicaid counts it as an asset, which is inexplicable. I have no idea why they made this rule this way. It's bizarre to me, but they do. So people like me are going to use that to my client's advantage and deliberately sort of inflate the countable assets. If we can do it in time, and it works really well if you've got $150,000 or less, or even up to $200,000, it works really well as a pre-planning technique, because all we have to do then is deed the house back out of the trust, and we've pretty well preserved all these assets. But again, your other assets have to be worth, you know, under $150,000 to $200,000 for that to really work well.
Some great benchmarks. Thank you. We have a call in the...
Yep. Anne is calling in from Traverse City today. Good morning, Anne.
Good morning.
Yes.
I'm wondering about contacting Medicaid. My 93-year-old mom passed away earlier this month. She had Medicare and most recently got Medicaid. I know that the Medicare has been notified about her death, but are we responsible to notify as a family Medicaid?
Where was your mom living?
She was living at the Pavilion.
No, Medicaid knows, so you don't have to notify
okay.
them. Did she have a house?
Okay. Yes.
Did she have a ladybird deed? Real life example here.
Yes, there is a ladybird deed.
She did. Okay, so just as an FYI, if the state of Michigan sends you a notice of intent to make a claim, that's the name of the form they send to try to make a claim against the estate, completion of that is voluntary. You don't have to you don't have to fill it out. And if she had a valid ladybird deed, she would be exempt from that. But the letter itself is a little scary. People get scared, and they fill it out because they don't know that completion's voluntary. So they fill it out, and then they keep getting more mail because they answer wrong. on the form because they don't know. So
So Medicaid then you're saying would be notified by the pavilion?
Yes.
Okay.
Oftentimes Medicaid knows before I do that my clients have passed.
Okay.
Like I don't even know when I get a form from them. So I think it's, I don't know the actual procedure, but it seems to be immediate.
Okay. Okay. And great, timely topic. Really good. And I would like to give three cheers to Connie at Alliance because she was a great help to us. She
Connie is awesome. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's wonderful. Is.
She just called the Alliance. That's the name of her business.
Oh, I knew you were going to ask
something
me that.
Like
it's like
that.
The Alliance for Independent Living, Senior Living.
Alliance
probably not independent.
Living,
probably
independent
not independent. Alliance.
In Traverse City,
senior,
you should be able
yes.
to find it. Okay, very
yep,
good.
Yep, she's fabulous. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for the great topic.
Thank you, Ann.
Thank you, Ann, in Traverse City, for calling New Retirement Radio with Dennis Proud and Company.
Ann,
that's the Alliance for Senior Housing, might be what they're talking. Is that what they're talking about?
Yes, that's it.
The stuff that we have to learn, get to learn, as we go through the aging process, and our parents do in some cases as well, can be daunting. The ability and or pre-thinking, if you will, to get counsel to establish these relationships, if I could give my own piece of advice, that would be the advice I would give. If you could, if you think, I'll just say it this way, that you can get your estate planning done on the internet, that'd be the last place on the planet I would go, given these conversations we've been having with attorneys in the last 3 to 6 months. And it's not some fear-induced thing. To me, it's just a practical use thing to be able to have a relationship with someone like you, Deb, where, in essence, I could consult when I think some of the worst things are happening in my life. I'll just say it that way. Mom or dad's health is failing. Who do I contact? What do I say? What are the forms that I'm going to need? Just all these pieces of the puzzle can be so valuable to have someone like yourself to walk me or and or my siblings through the same process.
Yes.
Incredible.
Yes. It's really, I think, I'm not, of course, a fan of internet forms, partly not because the forms themselves are always that bad, but because you don't know what you need and you don't understand how they work. And so that's part of the problem with them. I mean, I don't hate them. They're better than nothing, for sure. If people are not going to pay, they're better than nothing. But I try to look at the whole big picture and advise on everything. Estate planning, probate avoidance, tax issues, placement, services, making sure that we've set everything up for incapacity and death. And I used to, I think, when I was a brand new young lawyer, I was a little more uncomfortable talking with people about when you die or, if you become incapacitated. But I've learned you can't shy away from these things. And I think, Dennis, how we started this, we were talking about a mutual client, and you said, you know how to have the difficult conversations. And it's true. And I think most elder law attorneys do because, that's what we deal with is incapacity and death. And we really want to make sure that everybody's prepared as best as they can. And it usually saves money. It's counterintuitive that it saves money, but it usually does. And it definitely saves a lot of stress. Mm. So
that part can be invaluable, navigating this whole deal. Well, so we have a disclosure here, Deanne. We need to read, if you would, first.
Yes, absolutely. Deborah Riso of Riso Law is not affiliated with Prout Financial Design and LPL Financial. Mm. You're under no obligation to use the services of any of the entities referred and may choose any qualified professional to provide tax, CPA, legal, or trust services. These entities and their services are not affiliated with LPL Financial and Prout Financial Design. Thank you.
Okay. Check.
Okay.
All right. Thank you for joining us. We're so happy. All right. So we need to get this subject out into the open. Can you explain the 5-year look back period? Everyone asks about this.
Yes, and it's wildly misunderstood. So when you are applying for Medicaid to pay for long-term care, they ask you, the Department of Human Services is the Medicaid agency, and on their application, they ask you, what have you transferred for less than fair market value in the past 5 years? Unless you gave something to a disabled child, you are probably going to receive a Medicaid penalty on anything that you have given away within 5 years. And sometimes that's a deliberate planning technique on the part of elder law attorneys, but a lot of people are just giving assets away without consulting with an elder law attorney. So that results in a big problem for them, because a Medicaid penalty starts when you are otherwise eligible for Medicaid, meaning that you're pretty much down to $2,000, at least if you're single, and then Medicaid won't pay for your care for as long as however much money you transferred would have paid for your care. So it's highly problematic. What it doesn't mean is it doesn't mean that you have to do Medicaid planning more than 5 years in advance. The techniques that I use, typically we do when somebody needs long-term care. And a lot of times we'll plan for it, but we're usually not doing it 5 years in advance. That's pretty aggressive types of planning. And sometimes I do, but it's not as common, because it's risky to give away your assets and hope for 5 years to pass and hope that the person keeps your money. And you may never need Medicaid. And a lot of people have money in IRAs, and so we don't want to cash them out and pay the income taxes and give away the proceeds because of the tax implications. So it's pretty rare that I'm doing anything more than 5 years in advance, but I can certainly counsel people on that. But what I also, what people confuse all the time is the IRS rule on gifting and the Medicaid rule on gifting. Very few people will ever have to deal with IRS gifting resulting in taxes. You can give away $18,000 to as many people as you want without reporting it to the IRS. When you exceed that, you have to report it to the IRS, and then they are going to deduct that from your lifetime credit, which is a combination of what you've given away in your lifetime and what you die with, and that is the estate tax.
Estate taxes aren't payable until what level on the federal level?
Yeah, it's huge. It's like, I don't know. I think it's
25 to 26 million for a couple.
Right.
So most people are not going to hit that level.
Right, right.
So gifting in terms of tax through the IRS is almost non-existent.
It's irrelevant. But yes, people know that law. That everybody still thinks it's something like $10,000.
Right.
So they think that Medicaid honors that, so they'll do that gifting. Maybe if they have two kids and they'll do $20,000 a year, and then on year four somebody needs the nursing home and they've given away $80,000, that's going to result in a Medicaid penalty.
Mm.
And there's things we can do sometimes to fix that, but people don't understand that. And so I really always am trying to get out to people, be really cautious about gifting if you don't have a ton of money as you age, because it can be really problematic. And you really need somebody who knows what they're doing and that can advise you on it.
So many times you can help people with that gifting and at the same time can obey, if you will, that five-year look-back period, possibly through a Medicaid annuity or other planning vehicles that you might employ.
Right. I don't typically do gifting in any situation other than a single person. Usually with married people, we don't need to do any gifting, and I hope they haven't done any gifting if they're coming to me for Medicaid, unless they did it more than 5 years before. But again, I hope that people also are not perceiving me as saying that's always a good idea, because it's not always a good idea to give away assets and hope that you're clearing 5 years.
Okay, so many times it's not even going to be used for Medicaid is only usable if you're in a qualified long-term care facility and you qualify for the financial side as well.
Yes.
So that those two things are relatively narrow pieces to work through, or
yes,
narrow slivers,
yes,
if you
and,
will.
And so that's another really good point, Dennis, is that there's a paranoia about Medicaid that some people get as well, and it becomes their hyper-focus on what they're worried about with their estate. And a lot of times my clients now are not even going down the Medicaid path. They're opting to use the assisted living facilities and private pay and not even go down that route if they can avoid it.
Yep. Deb, you rock. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Deb.
Deb Riso.
Thanks, Ron.
All right, we'll wrap it up for Prout Financial Design's New Retirement Radio. Thank you, Dennis Prout, Heidi Cartwright, Deanne Jennings, all from Prout, and special guest Deborah Riso of the Riso Law Firm, 649-2903 for Riso. Thank you all.